Welcome to the Midday. I'm Norman Gilliland. We have the honor of a guest. Her name is Madore. Welcome.
Thank you.
One of the busiest, not just busiest violinists in the world, but one of the busiest people. If you look at all the things that you've been doing, but you're in Madison in particular this weekend to play with the Madison Symphony. Concerts Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday afternoon, including Haydn's London Symphony, that's the last of his 104, Ravel's La Valse, and you're playing the Shostakovich Violin Concerto No. 1. That is an action-packed work, and Shostakovich is a composer. You never know exactly what he's going to do, but you apparently have quite an affinity for this piece.
Oh, this is a fantastic work. It's beautiful, it's haunting, it's powerful, gives you a lot of energy, also gives you a lot of things to reflect on. It really is a fantastic piece.
It's got this great cadenza, I hear.
Yes, it comes it comes between the third and the fourth movements, the fourth being the final, and it's just an incredible, incredible violin concerto that showcases the instrument, of course, but the depth of the emotions that Shostakovich must have felt writing this, and for any player to come close to it, it's really a fabulous experience.
Last time I saw you, and I can't remember exactly when it was, a few years ago now, you were at the Olin House. That's the residence of the Chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. You were playing with three students from the UW. You were playing three movements of the Dvorak American Quartet. It was certainly a fabulous performance, especially in such close quarters. You play a lot with students, don't you? You do quite a bit of work around the country and around the world with young people.
One of the things I'm very, very committed to is community work through music, and a large portion of that work consists of making music with young people, collaborating with young musicians, and really trying to bring music into areas where the arts may not be so accessible, and just working with younger musicians so that they also have an experience of going out to the community with music and learning how to do it.
And you work with the underprivileged, too. Something like 150,000 young people have had the experience of working with you through one of your organizations.
I have three nonprofit organizations I started, and each is slightly different, but they are all community directed. Most have a lot to do with young people, and beyond the three organizations, I just engage myself in different projects that are on ongoing basis, and which again puts me in very close proximity with the young people. Then I teach at the University of Southern California.
Chair of the strings department.
That is correct, and I have my own group of students. And so I'm always surrounded by young people.
Well, speaking of young people, you were young by any standard when you started. Actually, next year, I believe, marks the 30th anniversary of your, we'll say, professional concert career.
Yes, 30 years. That's actually a long time. And it doesn't feel that it's been that long. I've been having a great time doing it. And I think this feeling of excitement, this feeling of being adventuresome, actually increases by the year.
So is it still kind of, a rush to go out on stage with all this music that you're getting ready to share? You've done this hundreds of times now. Is it still exciting for you?
I think for me the most interesting is the preparation. I do get a rush in starting a project and executing it and really being involved in the activities. Of course, often it culminates in a performance, but the process to really prepare, to collaborate, these are the most rewarding, most interesting parts of a performing career.
Well, let's go back. How many years would this be? This would be more than 20, let's say, for one of your first. This actually is your first commercial recording, I think.
It is, indeed.
And you, you and Pinchas Uckermann, some 20-plus years ago, let's say, collaborated with recordings of two concertos by Bach and two by Vivaldi for Philips. And this is the finale of the Bach Violin Concerto, and Ian playing also the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. The soloist, my guest today, Midori. That's the way it ends, the Violin Concerto in E by Bach. Pinchas Zukerman was the conductor of the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, and the soloist was Midori, back at the dawn of her recording career. She's my guest this afternoon for the midday, and she'll be performing with the Madison Symphony this weekend, the Shostakovich Violin Concerto No. 1. You also have, let's see, 2 degrees in psychology from New York University. And by the time you pursued those degrees, of course, you were already well steeped in music. You were already a professional musician. What brought about the interest in psychology? Why did you want to pursue those degrees?
When I started at NYU, of course, it being the liberal arts school, the beauty of it, of course, was that I had to take many different courses before really concentrating in a particular field. So I actually went to NYU not knowing that I would study psychology as my main concentration. I went and I thought that I was going to be doing something like art history, or perhaps combining that with education.
Music?
Well, I was already pursuing a musical career at that time, so I was looking to broaden my horizons and wanted to do different things. And so, you know, I started by thinking that it would be probably somewhere in the related field of the arts or education. But through the liberal arts corps, I had to take a social science class, and just fell upon a psychology, introduction to psychology class. Got me very, very interested. I was fascinated by the subject, and I decided that's what I actually wanted to pursue. And just a couple of semesters later, I was taking a literature course, and touched upon gender studies through that class, and got interested, and then decided that I wanted to have that as my subfield.
Do you think it connects or interacts at all as a musician? Do you think psychology and music, you know, as you have experienced them, interact?
I would say that, first of all, psychology is a very, very practical degree. It really trained me to read, to analyze, to have critical thinking, and also to write. And it was really a fantastic experience to be at NYU, to be in the academia. Also, I think the interdisciplinary aspect of my particular school that I attended at NYU, called the Gallatin School, this was really so good for me to be a part of, because it was so connected. It demonstrated in so many different ways, from so many different perspectives, that everything is intertwined, everything is interconnected. It's not just psychology and music, but I could also see from my brother's studies, who actually got a degree in physics, that, you know, music and physics could also be connected, and in the same way music and history could be connected, and music and biology could be connected. So many things. I mean, it really depends on how you present it and how you understand the subjects, and everything is connected, but it's just how you decide to approach them
and how you express it. This is, I must admit, a personal favorite, but it's also a kind of a piece of music that seems to stand alone in more ways than one. Is the Violin Sonata in A of César Franck, which you recorded also some time ago, earlier, much earlier in your career. It's almost kind of bluesy at times, isn't it, that first movement, given that it was written, I'm going to say, about 1875 or so. And you're performing here with a collaborator who has worked with you a lot, Robert MacDonald. So this is the first movement of that violin sonata in A of César Franck with Midori and Robert MacDonald. There's still something very distinctive and standalone about that sonata. That was the first movement of the Franck Violin Sonata in A, as played by my guest, Midori, with pianist Robert MacDonald. Are there certain, I'll call them stepping stones in a violinist's career where you say, okay, now I'm ready to play this piece, and that means I'm a certain level of ability?
Oh, actually, I don't know if there's such clear-cut lines, mm-hmm. but I mean, it certainly is not like, you know, there's staging for violin playing. Of course, sometimes with, you know, some of the testing things that they're doing now with children, they categorize things. But, and of course, there's somewhat of an expected order in which one learns repertoire or how one tries to balance exercises and repertoire or things like that. But I don't think there's any clear-cut sort of stage theory, so to say.
Well, you're playing some of the most famous of the solo violin pieces, the Paganini Caprices, at a very early age, weren't you?
I worked on those when I was very young, still living in Japan with my mother. And of course, you know, I've played and worked on them for many, many, many years since. And each time it's actually fun.
You find something different each time.
Well, it's also the challenge, you know, the physicalness of these caprices as well. You know, your body is changing, the caprice doesn't. And then, of course, you know, to figure out some of the physical sort of hurdles and the challenges and to come around it. It's always just, for me, interesting and inspiring process.
Well, you made, these are two short pieces, obviously, two of the caprices here that you recorded. You have since, I think, recorded all 24 of them, but this takes us back sometime prior to 1989. And I have to wonder just about the sheer conformation. In other words, if at this point you're a 12, 14-year-old girl and you're playing pieces that Paganini, with those legendary long fingers of his, had written for his own performances, what kind of accommodation, if any, do you have to make? Is just a smaller violin do it?
No. Well, by then I was playing a full-size instrument, and of course each caprice is different in terms of its demands, specific technical demands. But you just get to know yourself, and you get to know your instrument, and you get to know how your hands work. And really, a lot of this also is mental work.
Is it? Well, let's hear one of them anyway. This is the Caprice number 14. These years, do you find yourself playing along when you hear a recording of yourself so many years ago?
I actually try to tune out.
And why would that be?
I'm not particularly interested, perhaps, but I'm always more interested in looking forward, looking into the future. And so, you know, just things from the past, I, you know, okay, they're there. That's
relics.
Yeah.
So speaking of the future, you have some more considerable travels in your plans, don't you?
Oh, I think traveling is something that we do more than performing. I spend more hours, perhaps, traveling than actual time on stage. But some interesting places that I'm always looking forward to going. In terms of my community engagement work, I will be spending some time in Bangladesh next year.
What kind of things you'll be concertizing there, or the community work?
This is a community work that I do every year through my Japanese organization, Music Sharing. Mm-hmm. It's called the International Community Engagement Program, ICEP, and it's essentially a training program as well as an outreach. It trains the three young musicians that are selected by audition to come with me in a quartet. And we go to different orphanages, to hospitals, to schools in the developing countries. And next stop is Bangladesh. And we spend about 12 days over Christmas. And we'll be doing this. We were supposed to go to Bangladesh this December, next month, but this actually has been postponed to December 12, because it is actually sponsored by my Japanese organization, Music Sharing, and we are dedicating some of this time that was originally scheduled for Bangladesh to the work we would do in the Tohoku region of Japan, where the tsunami and the earthquake had hit.
What do you plan to do there?
It's a similar kind of work. This Music Sharing is a community service organization that I started in Japan, bringing music closer to the lives of people and children in particular, bringing artists in closer contact with citizens, with people, and again, particularly children.
Ultimately, that's where the music seems to come from, too, is the contact with people wherever you find them.
Mm-hmm. And I think this communication is very important, because without the communicative effort and the communicative aspect of music making, it doesn't actually become music. It's something that doesn't go from one side to the next to the other side, and really can't be done that way.
And you have quite, having looked at some of your websites and blogs, you have quite an involvement too with environmental issues, with green musicianship.
Well, I'm not saying that I'm a particularly professional at it, but I try to do my best as a citizen, try to do the best I can, turning off the lights whenever I can, shutting off computers on a regular basis every day. I don't just keep it on and let it just sort of be in the rest mode. I also travel with my own fork and my knife and my spoon. They're all wooden, so I can carry it in the carry-on with me. But
so
I don't have
tradition.
To use
long forgotten in most parts of the world. But you have to carry your own silverware and
yeah,
plate.
Yeah, and that because I don't like to use plasticware, and since I'm traveling so much and I'm doing so much takeout often, I could be using a lot of plasticware. And I also bring my own bowl if I'm doing a takeout of a salad. When traveling around, I bring my own plate, or in school, and things like that.
Smart idea. Just a little bit extra to carry, but worth it. Well, Midoriya, it's been a pleasure having you here today.
Thank you very much.
Look forward to your performance of the Shostakovich Violin Concerto No. 1 with the Madison Symphony. And for more information about those performances, Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday afternoon at Overture Center in Madison, you can go to the Madison Symphony Orchestra website, find out more about Midori and the upcoming concerts.